Okay, good morning. Let's get started. As we saw last week, in advance of Shemitah 5649, 1888, 1889, a group of rabbis, at the insistence of Baron Rothschild, came up with a solution to address the issue of Shemitah for the young yeshuv, the nascent yeshuv, these agricultural settlements that were being founded by these traditional and religious Jews from Eastern Europe. And based on earlier precedents, which we mentioned last week, Rav Shmuel Mohelever, who was the Rav of Bialystok and as scholars and historians would dub them, one of the proto-Zionists. He was a proto-Zionist. He was one of the Mevasrei Tzion, one of the founders of the Chovevei Tzion movement, which we discussed last week, together with Rav Yoshua Trunk, or Trank of Kutna, so big posek, big Talmud Chochom, who had very positive feelings towards Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael at the time, Rav Shmuel Klapfish, who was the Av Beit Din of Warsaw, along with the stamp of approval from Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, one of the leading poskim at the time, one of the Gedolei Hador. I mentioned that the school where I studied, the yeshiva where I studied, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, which is named for Rav Spector, YU, in their library, they have this whole exhibit dedicated, or the section of the library dedicated to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, and they call him a modern-day Rosh Kibahag, Rosh Shel Kol B'nei Hagola. Okay? So these Rabbonim, together with the stamp of approval of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, devised the Heter Mechira, again, based on earlier precedents, to allow members of this young yeshuv, this fledgling settlement, to work their land during the Shemitah year. And we looked at the original Heter together, and we examined the text, and it allowed for Malachot de Rabbanan, those activities that are only rabbinically prohibited. It allowed in the Heter of Rav Shmuel Mohelever and Rav Yoshua Kutna and Rav Shmuel Klapfish, it allowed for even Jews to work their land. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, I mentioned, was Machmir and insisted on Gentiles working the land. And if you noticed, the Heter that we read together had a clause. It said that it was only good for 1 year, okay? Only good for that Shemitah of 1888-1889. It had a tokef, if you will, an expiration date. So the issue would have to be revisited and renewed 7 years from then. And that has been, you know, sort of one of the approaches that poskim have taken, that you have to evaluate each Shemitah independently, individually, based on the current needs and the current situation. But nevertheless, it met with tremendous opposition, and leaders of the old yeshuv, Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the Rav of the Ashkenazi community in Jerusalem, we mentioned, along with Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, who was the Brisk Rav in Jerusalem, they vehemently opposed the Heter Mechira, and they saw it as a breach in halacha, a breach of tradition by this new yeshuv. And they saw members of the Chovevei Tzion as maskilim, as anti-religious nationalists, as secularists, you know, these modern Jews coming and developing these agricultural settlements. They saw it as a breach. And in fact, this led to a major rift, which we feel the ripples and reverberations of even today. Now, this initial heter, and we didn't have too much time to get into it last week, but it led to tremendous confusion in that first year of 1888-1889. It was something new. And so in that first year that the Heter Mechira was invoked, many of the moshavot, including Maskeret Batya, the very moshav that Rav Shmuel Mohelever founded, did not rely on the Heter. And there was confusion, and there was frustration, and there was anger. Baron Rothschild was furious. He had insisted that these moshavot, that he was bankrolling, observe Shemitah with the Heter Mechira. And in addition, maybe his ego was bruised. He wanted to save face. So he was very upset. And this led to many Jews abandoning the Moshavot, some even being thrown out of the Moshavot by Baron Rothschild and his land administrators. Even Eliezer ben Yehuda, the father of modern Hebrew, we mentioned last week, weighed in on the controversy. He had an interest in seeing the success of these settlements. Ironically, in the beginning, he supported those rabbis who said that you should follow Shemitah to a T and didn't allow for any leniencies because he felt that it would encourage more Jews from Eastern Europe to make Aliyah if they could observe Torah laws here in the land of Israel. It wasn't difficult. And then he changed his tune. He felt that, no, we should follow the Heter Mechira. Now, he wasn't a rabbi, he wasn't a posek, but he had some skin in the game, so to speak, because he wanted to see the Aliyah continue and strengthen and grow. And so following this disaster of 1888-1889, he laid the blame on the leaders of the old yeshuv, on Rav Shmuel Salant and on Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, the Briskerov, and he even called Rav Shmuel Salant the chief enemy of the new yeshuv. So Eliezer ben Yehuda goes as far as to call Rav Shmuel Salant the chief enemy of the new yeshuv. He felt that ultimately this approach threatened the growth and expansion of the new yeshuv and of Aliyah. And as I mentioned last week, this controversy begins to draw these clear lines in the sand between the old yeshuv and the new yeshuv. And as I said, the ripples and reverberations of which we feel until this very day. And in many ways, as I mentioned, this machloket shapes the religious and political landscape as we know it today. Divisions between the Haredi community and the Tzioni Dati communities and the Chiloni community. Okay. So there was confusion in the Moshavot themselves, and people left and people were thrown out. By the next Shemitah of 56-56, 1895-1896. So by now, the Heter Mechira had become more popular. By now, Rothschild had more control over the settlements. By now, the Heter Mechira became more accepted by rabbis. Again, in 1888, it was brand new. And with time, even Rav Shmuel Salant is said to have agreed, at least orally, with a limited type of Heter Mechira, a limited application. Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin approves a limited application of the Heter. We'll talk about that in a moment with this chidush of the then chief rabbi of Yafo, Rav Naftali Hertz. We'll speak about it in a moment. But you know, it's interesting. With time, the Heter becomes more widely accepted. At the same time, there was and still is major opposition. So the acceptance grows, as does the opposition. So this morning, I'd like to explore together with you just what some of that opposition to the Heter Mechira was and is. Okay, what's some of this opposition? Why all the opposition? You had major poskim that allowed for the Heter Mechira. So you have two major poskim that come out against the Heter Mechira, among those who do, but the two that I'll mention who are sort of early opposers of the Heter Mechira, in addition to Rav Shmuel Salant and Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, those who were living here in Israel at the time, the rabbis of Europe begin to start weighing in. And two of the major poskim at the time were the Beit HaLevi and the Nitziv, both of the Lajan, both major poskim, major Gedolei Torah. And part of the reason for their opposition was because they believed, based on their reading of the Rambam — this is the Rambam that we already explored in previous shiurim — but based on their reading of the Rambam, they believe that Shemitah nowadays is min haTorah, that it's deoraita, that it is biblical. Unlike most of the Rishonim and Achronim who believe that Shemitah nowadays is only rabbinic. So if we're talking about a Torah mitzvah, so there is much less room to be lenient. With a rabbinic law, we can be lenient. There's some latitude. We can invoke b'makom pseida lo gazru rabbanon, b'makom hefsed. If it's going to impose a serious financial loss on an individual, we can be lenient. If we're dealing with a Torah law, so, okay, it's a lot more difficult. And as we mentioned last week, the authors, so to speak, of the Heter Mechira assumed that Shemitah Bizman Hazeh, like the overwhelming majority of poskim, is only rabbinic. That's what it was based on. That's the assumption. As I mentioned, there are those who believe, this is a minority opinion, but there are those who believe that Shemitah nowadays is only a midat chassidut, or like a minhag. It's a pious custom, but it's not even a formal rabbinic enactment. Okay, but most assume it's a rabbinic enactment. So what's interesting is both the Beit HaLevi and the Nitziv supported the Chovevei Tzion movement. Initially, in its infancy, the Beit HaLevi supports the movement, but then ultimately withdraws his support. As I mentioned last week, you know, this was a unique movement that was really a joining of forces between two strange bedfellows, the religious Zionist community, the early religious Zionist community, the Mevasrei Tzion, and secular Zionists, or very early secular Zionists, okay? So initially, the Beit HaLevi lends his support, then withdraws his support. It was a mixed organization. As I mentioned last week, ultimately, the religious element breaks away from the Chibat Tzion or Chovevei Tzion movement and forms the Mizrahi, okay? So the Nitziv, who was more open in his worldview, continues to support the Chovevei Tzion, the Chibat Tzion movement. And yeah, we have letters of his. He writes very passionate letters supporting the movement. He was a big religious Zionist. The Kibbutz Ein HaNitziv, of course, is named for him. A lot of those early kibbutzim, those religious kibbutzim, were named for these Mevasrei Tzion, these heralders of Zion we mentioned last week. And so, as I said, the basis for their hesitation, or their opposition, is the fact that according to the Beit HaLevi and the Nitziv, based on their reading of the Rambam, Shemitah nowadays is deoraita. You know, we said in previous shiurim that Shemitah, at least according to most, is dependent on the Yovel. The Torah says, "Ukratim dror ba'aretz lechol yoshveha." You shall proclaim freedom throughout the land to all of its inhabitants. So it requires all of its inhabitants. Kol yoshveha aleha, the Gemara says. We discussed what that means. Does it mean a majority? Does it mean that the Jews are returning to their tribal plots, that each tribe somehow relocates to where their tribe was, where they had a nachala, an inheritance? But in any case, according to most Rishonim and Achronim, when you don't have Yovel, so Shemitah is only the Rabbanan. But again, according to the Nitziv, and the Beit HaLevi, and it's almost ironic because the Nitziv supports this movement and supports the settlement and writes so passionately about it and is such a strong religious Zionist, an early religious Zionist. Nevertheless, he was against the Heter Mechira because he believed that Shemitah is deoraita. Others, the Aruch HaShulchan, one of the major poskim at the time, another Litvishgon, was against the Heter Mechira. Shamshon Rafael Hirsch at the time was against the Heter Mechira. Now, he issues a letter in December of 1888, just a few days before his death, calling on the Jewish community to raise money for the yeshuv and allow them to observe Shemitah, along with other rabbis and poskim at the time. Again, as I mentioned last week, Baron Rothschild and others wanted to move the new yeshuv away from this old model of having to rely on handouts from the Jewish communities of Europe, what's called the chalukah. Those who were against their Heter Mechira had no choice. So they had to try and raise money for these Jewish farmers to allow them to sit back and let their land lie fallow. So you had Rav Mordechai Gimbel Yaffe, for example, who was Litvish Agon. He was one of the founders of the Chovevei Tzion movement, the Chibat Tzion movement. He moves to Israel in the Shemitah year of 1888, this watershed moment, if you will, this transformative year. And interestingly, refuses the invitation of the old yeshuv, who wanted to claim him as their own and instead settles in Maskeret Batya. We mentioned initially it was called Ekron. And he wrote articles in the newspapers and letters calling on the community to support the new Yishuv financially and to sustain them during the Shemitah year so that they would not have to work their fields. Some of the other rabbis who signed off and encouraged financial support mentioned the Beit HaLevi already, the Or Sameach, Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen of Divinsk, also Mage Talmud Chacham at the time. He was also a big supporter of the Chibat Zion, Chovevei Zion movement. The Sfat Emet, the Gerer Rebbe, okay, he encouraged Jews to support the Yishuv financially. Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, among others, tried to raise money. And this is a model that exists until this very day. We'll talk maybe later on this morning about Keren HaShvi'it, this organization which you see advertising in the newspapers now, encouraging Jews to make donations to support religious farmers so that they can keep Shemitah without having to rely on the Heter Mechira, without having to work their land. So you mentioned this organization that's trying to sell plots of land. That's an interesting new take on it, right? They're encouraging Jews abroad to buy a plot of land here in Israel and fulfill the mitzvah of Shemitah, and then use those funds to support Jewish farmers. Okay, so it's a slightly different take. It allows them to feel good. Not only is the money going to support Jewish farmers, but they feel like a sense of ownership that they have a plot in the land of Israel. Okay. Which is going to lie fallow. It's not going to be worked. Correct. Right. It's interesting. You have a number of organizations. Okay. The Nitziv, who I mentioned, was against the Heter Mechira. He believed that by observing Shemitah, and he writes this, by observing Shemitah together with the other mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz, which are not always easy, he believed it to be a great Kiddush Hashem, in that Jews and non-Jews alike will see the tremendous bounty and blessings that God bestows on the land. And they will see that Eretz Yisrael is not like other lands, as the Torah promises. Eretz Yisrael merits this additional level of hashkacha prati, divine providence. The Torah says the eyes of Hashem are on this land from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And as the Torah promises, if you will ask, what will I eat during the Shemitah year, the Torah says that you'll have enough bounty, enough excess in the sixth year to provide you for the sixth, seventh, and the eighth year before you can start reaping the benefits of your new crop in the eighth year. So the Nitziv really believed that if you kept Shemitah, you would see blessings from Hashem, and this would only encourage people to make Aliyah. Again, it's kind of ironic. The Nitziv, who is so passionate about settling the land of Israel, he's against the Heter Mechira. But he believed that by keeping Shemitah, Kihilcheta, that ultimately would be a Kiddush Hashem and would encourage people to make Aliyah. So in addition to this concern whether Shemitah nowadays is d'oraita, the Nitziv had another concern. He raised another issue, which later poskim like the Chazon Ish, who we'll get to, also raise. And that's the issue of the Isur of Lo Techonen. The Torah in Dvarim Perek Zayin, Deuteronomy chapter 7, says, Ki yaviyacha Hashem elokecha el haaretz asher tavashama lirishta. V'nashal goyim rabim ipanecha. Achiti v'hagirgashi v'hamori v'haknani v'haprizi v'hachivi v'hayivusi. In the different Canaanite nations, right? Shiva goyim rabim v'atsumim mimecha. Mimecha. When Hashem, your God, brings you into the land that you enter to possess it, He will dislodge all of these nations before you, the Chiti, the Girgashi, the Emori, the Knani, all these different Canaanite nations. Unetanam Hashem Elokecha lefanecha, v'yikitam hacharim tacharimein, otam lo tichrot lahem brit, v'lo techonein. Hashem, your God, will deliver them to you and you will defeat them. We have this mitzvah to wage war against these seven Canaanite nations. You have to destroy them. And then the Torah says, V'lo techonein. and you're not to show them any chen, any grace. Different ways to translate it. Torah continues, lo titchaten bam, you're not to marry with them, bitcha, velo titen livno, vito lo tikach vanecha, lo livnecha, you're not supposed to give your daughters to them, take your sons, don't mingle with them. All right, lest your children turn away from Hashem and worship other gods, the Torah continues. So there are different explanations in the Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah as to what this prohibition of lo techonem is. And one of the explanations, one of the drashot is lo titen lahem chanaya bakarka. You're not allowed to give them any land. Now, what are the parameters of that isur? What is the extent of that isur, of this prohibition? To whom does it apply? Interesting. So the Nitziv writes in a tshuva, in his Meshiv Devar, that here, now he personally held that Shemitah was deoraita, was biblical, based on his reading of the Rambam, as I mentioned. But the Nitziv writes the following. He said, according to most poskim, Shemitah bizman hazeh is only the Rabbanan, it's only rabbinic. So here, in an attempt to circumvent a rabbinic law, what are you doing? You're transgressing a biblical prohibition, an Isur Torah of Lo Techoneh. And he writes, it's as if you're running from the wolf right into the arms of the lion. Okay, that's his famous expression of his, this famous metaphor of his. You, in order to get around a rabbinic prohibition of working the land, it's only rabbinic nowadays, you are violating this Torah prohibition. It's as if you're running from a wolf straight into the arms of a lion. Now, it's interesting. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who gave his stamp of approval to that Heter Mechira, he addresses this issue and explains, based on earlier sources, that this prohibition of Lo Techonem only applies to idolaters. And who were they selling the land to? Presumably they were selling the land to Muslims. And most poskim, the overwhelming majority of poskim, assume that Islam is not Avodah Zarah. There is a minority opinion, but without getting into it this morning, most assume that Islam is not Avodah Zarah. It's a monotheistic religion. That means a Jew perhaps can even enter into a mosque. That's another interesting discussion I've written about in the past and spoken about. But what's interesting here is Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, one of the early poskim to address this very issue, says it's not a problem because this Isur only applies to an idolater. And the Muslim that we sell the land to is not an idolater. Interestingly, nowadays, the Rabbanut sells the land to completely avoid this concern. Rabbanut sells the land to a ger toshav. Now, far beyond the scope of our discussion this morning, can you even accept gerei toshav bizman hazeh, who can have a status of a ger toshav? But they sell the land to a Russian immigrant, I think someone from maybe the Ukraine, who has a Jewish grandfather, right? Someone who qualifies for the law of return, but is not Jewish al pi halacha. Someone who keeps the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach as a Ger Toshav must do. And that's who they sell the land to. They sell all the land that's included in the Heter Mechira. They sell to this one individual. So they skirt around this issue. Certainly he's not an idolater. He's a Ger Toshav. He keeps the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Again, can we accept Geri Toshav? That's beyond the scope of our discussion this morning. Another answer to this opposition or this argument. Another approach was that of Yoshua Trunk of Kutno, who, again, was one of the poskim who signed that first Heter Mechira in advance of Shemitah 1888-1889, together with Rav Shmuel Moaliver. So in his Yeshuot Malko, he examines the nature of the Isur and asks, what is this Isur ultimately about? We read a few psukim from Devarim, Perek Zion, that it's about these idolatrous nations and not giving them land and not showing them favor, and you have to uproot them and not intermarrying with them, not giving them your daughter or your son in marriage. He says, look at the context What is the nature of this prohibition? The nature of this prohibition is ultimately about losing a foothold or a stronghold in Eretz Yisrael. But if by selling them the land, it ultimately is for the benefit of Jewish settlement to ensure that we maintain our foothold on the land. So then he writes, there's no prohibition of lotei chonen. This is the whole isur of lo titen lahem chanaya bakarka, giving them land, is so that you're going to come to lose the land. That's the nature of the isur. He says, the heter mechira, it sells them the land so that you can ensure that you maintain the land in Jewish hands ultimately. Okay, I mentioned that in the Shemitah prior, 1881, you had the Jewish community, the settlement of Petach Tikva was abandoned. Now, scholars and historians will debate whether what did them in was malaria and disease or whether it was the Shemitah that did them in. But they abandoned the settlement. It had to be resettled several years later. So according to Rav Yoshua Kutno in his Yoshuat Malko, he writes, there's no prohibition of lo techonim if the intent is to sell the land in order to ultimately maintain your foothold on the land, maintain the land, keep the land in Jewish hands. Rav Kook, who we will discuss more in depth shortly, I know last week you were asking Rabbi Leib about Rav Kook's opinion. So Rav Kook, together with Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim, major posek, major important figure in the Rabbanut, the early Rabbanut, they explained that since the sale is only temporary, there's no violation of the prohibition of lo techonim. What is the isur of lo techonim? That's giving them lo titen lahem chanaya bakarka. You're giving them a foothold in the land. But if the sale is only temporary, you're not really giving them anything. And in fact, as we saw last week when we examined together the actual text of that first heter, it said that after the year, the land is going to revert to its original owners, which, by the way, we'll address in a few moments because maybe that would seem to undermine the sale. But in any case, for Rav Kook and Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and other poskim, since the sale is only temporary, it's not a violation of lo techonim. That's giving them a permanent share in the land. This is only temporary. Okay. Some say that the isur of lo techonim nowadays is only rabbinic, and that's additional reason to be lenient with it. Rav Naftali Hertz, who was the Rav in Yafo before Rav Kook, I mentioned him just a few moments ago, he came up with a modified version of the Heter Mechira to address this issue, which met the approval of Rav Shmuel Salant and Rav Shua Leib Diskin. He very creatively said, what we can do is, instead of selling them the land, right, which may be a violation of this Isur Torah of Lo Techonim, let's sell them instead the trees and the plants that grow, but not the land, just the plants and the trees, everything above the ground. Okay, creative, but questionable whether that works or not. At the end of the day, the trees are still rooted in the ground and the plants are still rooted in the ground. In any case, that was one way to get around it. But what's interesting is, and what's important for our discussion this morning, and certainly in order to understand Rav Kook's approach, is that already the Rav in Yafo, Rav Naftali Hertz, believed in supporting the Heter Mechira, at least a modified version of the Heter Mechira. Okay? That's possible. That's possible. Was his approval because Yafo was at the time, you know, Yafo, we think of Yafo as the city, but, you know, there were farms there and just outside of Yafo. Maybe his approval was because Yafo was closer to the agricultural settlements. You could argue that maybe the rabbis in, you know, the old yeshuv within the walls of Jerusalem were detached. That's an interesting way of looking at it. It could be. It could be. But look, it's the job of a posek, wherever he lives, to understand what's going on in the shetach, the mitziyut. So it could be, or it could be he just had a different approach to this halachic question. It wasn't necessarily a matter of how were they in touch with the farming that was going on, or were they disconnected? You had a question in the back, Rav David. How does the Het HaMechira compare to the sale of chametz? So the sale of chametz is already discussed in the Gemara. So there's already a precedent from the Gemara. That's first of all, the Mishnah, the Gemara, right? Chazal already. So there already is a big difference. The Het HaMechira was seen as this, you know, new chiddush introduced by these reformers coming from Europe, part of the Yishuv HaChadash, this new young Yishuv. I think that's one major difference. There were those who drew parallels and drew comparisons. The difference is, at least with regards to this issue of Lo Techonem, is there's no problem. I mean, you're not allowed to own chametz, of course, right, on Pesach. So you sell your chametz. But there's no problem in selling chametz. The sale itself doesn't violate any other issue. There's a question whether the sale works or not. Maybe it's still yours, and maybe you're still over on Bal Yireh Bal Yimatzeh. That's a different discussion, whether the sale works or not, what the sale requires. But inherent in the sale is no violation, whereas maybe inherent in the sale of the land of Israel, there is this Torah violation of Lo Techonem. But others, we'll see in a moment, at least with regards to understanding how sales work in halacha in general, there are those who draw comparisons and bring mechirat chametz, the sale of chametz, as a proof, as a precedent, as some evidence. We'll touch on that shortly. Let's fast forward to 1904. Between 1904 and 1914, you have a major aliyah, which is dubbed the Second Aliyah. It sees approximately 35,000 Jews immigrating to Israel, mostly from the Russian Empire, small contingent from Yemen. And this historic aliyah really lays the groundwork for the establishment of the State of Israel. But it's a very different kind of aliyah. We mentioned last week that the first aliyah was primarily traditional, primarily religious, inspired by the Mevasrei Tzion, the Chibat Tzion, Chovevei Tzion movements. Although you did have a small secular contingent we didn't mention last week, Bilu, okay, the Bilu movement. But the second aliyah is very different. It's an aliyah of secular Zionists. By now you have secular Zionism, okay? So it's primarily a second aliyah. And the turn of the 20th century sees tens of thousands of new immigrants, the overwhelming majority of which are secular. So the poskim now, this new group of poskim living in Israel in the 20th century, have to address the question of Shemitah observance once again, specifically to address the needs of this new growing population. Now, beyond just mere survival, which we discussed last week, the hunger, the famine, disease, malaria, all the challenges they faced in the late 19th century, now maybe the challenges are different. Maybe now you have to try and make Shemitah in addition to those other challenges, but maybe now you have additional challenges. You have to make Shemitah and religious observance, Torah observance, as easy and as accessible as possible to encourage Torah observance among this new wave, among this new aliyah, these new immigrants. So Rav Kook moves to Eretz Yisrael and becomes the Rav of Yafo in 1904. Now, interestingly, while still in Europe, Rav Kook was uncomfortable with the Het HaMechira. Okay, there's a lot to say on this, but I see we're already running out of time. But here, and maybe this goes to your question, here now he's the Rav of Yafo, and he inherits this position from Naftali Hertz, who I mentioned had relied on the Het HaMechira. He augmented it, he had his own version, but he implemented at least his version of the Het HaMechira. So Rav Kook, with the position, inherited the Het HaMechira. Okay, that was, you know, even nowadays, certain rabbis, they take a position and they inherit certain leniencies that they may not have been comfortable with, but that's the current reality. And, you know, very difficult for a rabbi to change something, to go backwards once the community is already being lenient with a certain issue, although sometimes it happens. You have a lot of interesting stories, but not for now. But Rav Kook, and maybe addressing your question, is now responsible not only for Yafo, but for the surrounding settlements as well. And you see his hesitancy, even in his reliance on the Heter Mechira. On many issues related to Shemitah, he is very machmir. Okay, he writes a whole Sefer, Shabbat Haaretz, about Shemitah, about the Heter Mechira. And on the one hand, he's lenient and responds to the needs of the yeshuv and encourages other rabbis to respond to the needs of the yeshuv. And he's someone who feels like you have to respond to the needs. You can't live detached. You can't live cloistered off in an ivory tower. On the other hand, he also writes that we should constantly be looking for solutions other than the Heter Mechira to properly observe Shemitah. Maybe we'll mention some of those, or at least one of them this morning, at least in passing, like the oats are baked in. I'm sorry, what did you want to say? He was a Talmid of the Nitziv, although, unlike the Nitziv, Rav Kook believed that Shemitah nowadays is only Durabanan. And unlike the Nitziv, he relied on Heter Mechira and did not see the Isur of Lotachonim as a problem. But he did study in Volozhin under the Nitziv and was very close to the Nitziv. You are correct. At the time when Rav Kook was the Rav in Yafo, the Ritbaz was the Rav in Tzfat. And the Ritbaz was his Bar Plukta, his major opponent on this very issue. Rav Yaakov David Vilovsky, the Ritbaz, was a Rav and Rosh Yeshiva in Slutsk, major gaon. He wrote Perushim on the Bavli, on the Yerushalmi. And while traveling in the United States to raise money to publish his Sfarim, he was appointed Rav of Chicago. There's an incredible story about how he got into Sikhsuch in Machloket with the Shochtim, the slaughterers of Chicago at the time in the early 20th century, major place of Shechita. I'm sorry? Major meat center, right? So all the beef coming from the Midwest would pass through and be transported all over the United States. So as happened in many places, there are a number of stories of this. Rav Moshe Feinstein, even when he was the Rav in Luban, you know, the rabbi got into a fight with the shochtim, right? And oftentimes the shochtim would bully the rabbi. In this particular case, they even threatened the Ritbaz's life, or the Ritbaz's life. Okay? According to the story, he had to flee on Shabbos with his family to New York. He got on a train on Shabbos, according to the story. Pikuach Nefesh, if you're interested, Rabbi Rakefet has published on the life of the Ritbaz. He published a monograph, a scholarly article. I'm sorry? It's in his collected writings. Many years ago, I looked through the article at the National Library, the Sifra Leumit here in Jerusalem, if anyone's interested. Fascinating. So he has to run to New York on an Erev Shabbos, on a Leil Shabbos, you know, Pikuach Nefesh. And ultimately, he settles in Eretz Israel in 1905, where he builds the yeshiva and becomes the Rav in Tzfat. And he becomes a major opponent of Rav Kook's with regards to the Heter Mechira. And he voices his opposition in his commentary to the Pa'at HaShulchan. Now, the Pa'at HaShulchan is a fascinating sefer. Unfortunately, it's out of print nowadays. Only the old printings, if anyone's interested in putting out a new scholarly version of the Pa'at HaShulchan, a new edition, it's certainly something that is very much necessary. So the Pa'at HaShulchan is the work of Rav Yisrael Mishklov, who was one of the Talmidei Hagra, one of the close students of the Vilna Gaon. As we mentioned last week, the Vilna Gaon in the early 19th century, the Vilna Gaon, he dies in the late 18th century, but the Vilna Gaon sends his students on Aliyah in the early 19th century. Many students of the Vilna Gaon come on Aliyah in the early 19th century, in the first half, in advance of what they believed to be the coming of the Mashiach in 1840. They wanted to be there and bring about the redemption and see the coming of the Mashiach in 1840, they believe, based on statements in the Midrashic literature and the Zohar, that the Mashiach was going to come in 1840. So among his students is Rav Yisrael of Shklov, And he writes the Sefer, the Pata Shulchan, on the Mitzvot Tatzliot Ba'aretz, the agricultural laws. It's a fascinating Sefer. And in his introduction, he describes all the challenges they faced. There was earthquakes and disease and plagues, and everyone was dying. He suffered tremendous personal loss. His whole family died. It was just awful. So the Ritvaz writes a Perush, a commentary to the Pata Shulchan, and there he attacks the Het HaMechira. Okay. Now it's interesting. In 1909, the Ritvaz turns to Rav Kook. They were the two major Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael at the time. He turns to Rav Kook to approach Baron Rothschild for financial support in advance of the Shemitah year. And Rav Kook refuses, instead saying that we have to find support and justifications for the Heter Mechira and support the struggling farmers. Now the Chazon Ish arrives in Israel in 1933. By the way, many don't know this, with the help of Rav Kook, among others. By then already, 1933, Rav Kook is older. Remember, he dies in 1935. But the arrival on the Chazon Ish represents another tkufa, another period, another stage in this whole Shemitah controversy. With the arrival of the Chazon Ish in 1933, it once again stirs up the controversy. And the Chazon Ish spends a lot of time writing, a lot of ink spilled, writing about Shemitah and about the Heter Mechira. Now, it's fascinating. Rav Rimon, in his Sefer, which I showed you last week, fabulous Sefer, both in Hebrew and English, although I prefer the Hebrew edition. He writes with such clarity that sometimes the English doesn't always capture. I apologize to the translator. No hard feelings, not personal. But it's hard to translate a Sefer, obviously. Things always get lost in translation. But in both Hebrew and English editions, in the back, it's almost like an appendix, there's a chapter which compares Rav Kook's approach with the Chazon Ish's approach. Okay, and we don't have time. We're almost out of time, but I'll just mention that it's fascinating that, you know, the Chazon Ish is always associated with the Machmir opinion with regards to his shiurim, his measurements, right? Bigger than everyone else is the Chazon Ish versus Rav Chaim Noah, right? And with many areas of halacha, he's always associated with the Machmir opinion, correct? So it's fascinating. Both the Chazon Ish and Rav Kook believed that Shemitah nowadays is only the Rabbanan, it's only rabbinic. Nevertheless, it's almost counterintuitive. Rav Kook, who relies on the Heter Mechira in many other areas, in many other instances, and even with the Heter Mechira, has all sorts of additional stringencies. He's very careful. Could be provoked by his tremendous feelings of the Kedushat Haaretz, the sanctity of the land. Whereas the Chazon Ish, where he rejects the Heter Mechira, he's a lot more lenient in so many areas with regards to Shemitah, because it's only Durabanan Bizman Hazeh. And if you're not going to rely on the Heter Mechira, so you have to find other creative ways of allowing people to survive. So on the one hand, Rav Kook, he relies on the Heter Mechira, but is very machmir in many ways and many areas, many instances. And the Chazon Ish, who rejects the Heter Mechira, is very lenient because Shemitah Bizman Hazeh is only Durabanan. Okay, so Rimon has this whole chapter where he compares and contrasts the shitot of Rav Kook and the Chazon Ish. Although by the time the Chazon Ish comes on the scene, Rav Kook is already no longer very active. So the two of them didn't really have too much to say to one another about Shemitah, at least during Rav Kook's life. But the Chazon Ish is certainly responding to a lot of the things that Rav Kook and others wrote. Now, I'll just mention, as an aside, I mentioned, Rav Kook came up with some solutions. One suggestion was what becomes known as the Otsar Beit Din, which is very popular nowadays. But it wasn't really considered seriously until the 1940s when the Chazon Ish begins to explore it seriously. So that's another interesting intersection between Rav Kook and the Chazon Ish, where you might think, you know, they would be polar opposites, and it's counterintuitive, but on many issues they actually agree. And on this particular issue, it's counterintuitive, it's almost ironic. Here Rav Kook, who relies on the Heter Mechira, is very stringent with regards to Shemitah, whereas the Chazon Ish, who rejects the Heter Mechira is lenient in many areas of Shemitah because he believes it's only rabbinic nowadays. Okay, Beseder, it could be. We'll talk about the Heter, we'll talk about the Otzer Beitin if we have time. One issue which the Chazon Ish and others raise, which Rav Kook already addresses, is that maybe the sale is not a real sale. It's just a legal fiction. Some discuss that with regards to Mechirat Chametz as well. Especially as we saw the original Heter, in the text of the Heter, it says that this sale is only good for 1 year, and at which time, after this contract expires, the land will return to its rightful owners. So how valid is that sale? In addition, some raised at the time, including the Chazon Ish, but even before, the sale was not registered with the Tabu, I think it's called, the official land, the Tabu, the official land registry, whether it was under the Ottomans, or the British, or following the establishment of the State of Israel. So I'll just mention that nowadays, everything is official. The rabbinate ensures that it is a valid sale according to Israeli law. But at the time, the Chazon Ish and others questioned the validity of the sale. If it's only going to go back to Jewish hands at the end of the year, maybe it's not a sale. And if the sale is not registered in the official land registry, so that undermines the validity of the sale. That shows that you have no intent to actually sell what you're trying to sell. And that invokes the issue of Gemirat Dat. When you sell something, there has to be Gemirat Dat. There has to be full disclosure, if you will. Okay? It has to be a real sale. So Rav Kook and Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank wrote that even if the sale is not on the books, so to speak, it's still a valid sale, at least according to halacha, because the two parties have an agreement. They write up a contract, even though it's not on the official books, it's not in the land registry. Some drew on a tshuva of the Divrei Chaim, Rav Chaim of Tzanz, and maybe this addresses your question, Rav David, that the sale of chametz, the Divrei Chaim writes, even without the official seal, the Gushpanka, the stamp of the secular courts at the time, I guess in certain places, in order for a sale to be valid, it had to have some official stamp of the secular government. The Divrei Chaim considered it a valid sale. Again, it's an agreement in writing between a Jew and Gentile. Halacha views it as a sale, even though maybe it's off the books officially. But the Chazon Ish rejected this and felt, no, if the sale is not registered with Israel's official land registry, that undermines the sale. It's not a valid sale. Again, today this is not a concern because the Rabbanut makes sure that everything is done according to Israeli law. Okay. Another reason for the Chazon Ish's opposition, he ruled like the Mabit. Now, if you recall, we discussed this at length, mentioned it a number of times. There's a major machloket between the Beit Yosef and the Mabit with regards to whether the land retains its kiddusha while in Gentile hands. Now, the Beit Yosef and the Mabit, who were living in the 16th century, were not addressing the sale of the land per se, but they addressed a similar scenario. What if you have land that's owned by a Gentile during the Shemitah year? Does the produce from that land need to be tithed? Do you have to remove Trumot and Ma'asrot? Or do you say no, during the Shemitah year, since everything is Hefker, as we've explained, there's no obligation to remove Trumot Uma'asrot. Now, the Mabit felt that the land retains its kiddusha even while in Gentile hands. So you do not remove Trumot Uma'asrot. That was the point of contention. That was the Nukudana Machloket. That's what they were arguing about. Whereas the Beit Yosef or Yosef Karo, who many Paskin like, felt no. If the land is owned by a non-Jew, it loses its kiddushat Shemitah, kiddushat Shvi'it. The land is released of its obligation of Shemitah, and therefore you would have to tithe its produce. You would have to separate Trumot Uma'asrot. Okay, now most Paskin like the Beit Yosef, and the authors of the Heter Mechira, those who invoked the Heter Mechira, assumed, like the Beit Yosef, that when land is owned by a non-Jew during the Shemitah year, that land is released of its obligation of Shemitah, doesn't have Kiddushat Shvi'it. That's how they Paskin. However, again, there's this opinion of the Mabit, who was also a major posek at the time. He actually served together with the Beit Yosef on the Beit Yosef's Beitin, which we mentioned, okay, in Sfat. And the Chazon Ish paskin like the Mabit. Okay, so that's another major reason why the Chazon Ish rejected the Heter Mechira, even though, as we mentioned, the Chazon Ish believed that Shemitah Bizman HaZeh is the Rabbanah. Okay? So, in addition to his leniencies, as I mentioned, the Chazon Ish, on the one hand, rejects Heter Mechira, but has all these leniencies, he also sets up the Keren HaShmitah, which you have until this day. These funds, this fund, Keren HaShmitah, and other funds which collect money from Jews abroad in order to allow Jewish farmers here in Israel to observe Shemitah, Kedat, Kedin without relying on the Heter Mechira. So these are just some of the objections raised to the Heter Mechira by those poskim who opposed it. Now, with the establishment of the State of Israel, Chief Rabbi Rav Herzog and the Sephardic Chief Rabbi Rav Uziel, together with Ritzvi Pesach Frank, we mentioned it already this morning, they adopt the Heter Mechira, and it becomes the official position of the State of Israel. Fast forward to Shemitah 5767, 2007-2008, not too long ago. In advance of Shemitah 5767, the Chief Rabbinate makes a very interesting decision. And this perhaps represents their move to the right, as has happened over the decades, that they said they're going to leave the decision up to the individual municipalities. In other words, they're not going to impose the Heter Mechira on all of the State of Israel, but instead, you know, the rabbinate of Haifa, let's say, will make a decision for the surrounding areas and the farms in their jurisdiction, whether they're going to allow for Heter Mechira or not. The rabbinate of Jerusalem will make their decision. Each ezor, each region, each moatzah, each city, each rabbinate will decide for themselves. And so many rabbinates decided not to rely on the Heter Mechira. Again, the chief rabbinate over the years has moved to the right. I don't know if I should be going this way or this way. This is my right. So interesting. What happened was the farmers took the issue to the Bagatz, Israel's Supreme Court, and the Bagatz ruled no. The chief rabbinate has to make a decision for the entire State of Israel. So they, because of the pushback, they backtracked and said, okay, we'll follow the Heter Mechira, but they introduced a number of chumrot and hidurim into their sale. Now, last Shemitah, just 7 years ago, in advance of the last Shemitah, the chief rabbinate, introduced something else, some other new concept. Mahadrin and regular, or ragil. Okay, Mahadrin, which does not rely on Heter Mechira, instead uses Yivul Nochri, produce, Gentile produce, produce coming from outside of Eretz Yisrael, from Gentile lands. Okay, some perhaps coming from places, fun places like Gaza, the Gaza Strip. Our good friends over there, our cousins. That's the Mahadrin. Okay, you want to be from, that's Mahadrin. And so whether it's supermarkets or whether it's restaurants, if you want your tudat to say Rabbanut Mahadrin, you have to use Yibul Nochri, can't rely on the Heter Mechira, and then regular kashrut, which relies on the old standard, the gold standard, the Heter Mechira. And it will be interesting to see how it plays out this year with what's going on with regards to kashrut in the country right now. Because as you know, the government has decided to democratize kashrut, to open it up to everybody. Well, what the decision is, and this is still being, the Rabbanut is pushing back and saying they're not going to go along with this, but the government has decided that they're going to allow, privatize. They're allowing the privatization of kashrut, which means that they're going to allow people to, or agencies, people to create independent kashrut organizations, independent hashkachot, independent supervision agencies, kashrut companies, with the Rabbanut acting as a governing body, as an oversight body, overseeing what these independent organizations are doing. So it opens up the playing field. It completely democratizes kashrut. We'll see how long this lasts. We'll see what happens, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens with regards to Shemitah, okay? This is next week already, but again, so Shemitah, it's interesting. Shemitah is not only this year, but it goes even into the eighth year because all the produce that comes from this year. Okay, so it's going to be interesting how the Rabbanu navigates this. The current policy of the Rabbanut is Mahadrin Ragil, like last time, like 7 years ago, Mahadrin Ragil. Okay, and you know, as we began with last week, this machloket, Shemitah and Heter Mechira, it's so divisive. This is a controversy that raises its head, that rears its ugly head, if I can call it ugly, every 7 years. And in many ways, this machloket has shaped the divisions within Jewish life that we have today, as we saw. You know, people won't eat by other people. In the Haredi world, they will solely eat Yivul Nochri. They won't even rely on Otsar Beit Din, or they don't want to touch anything that may have Kedushat Shvi'it even. Forget Heter Mechira. But in the Haredi world, they rely on, they will only eat Yivul Nochri, Gentile produce, some of which coming from our cousins in Gaza. 7 years ago, my wife was in Osher Ad, and she comes back with a bag of carrots that say product of Gaza, in big letters on the carrots. As Rav Gold once said, if you're going to rely on Yibul Nochri, make sure to wash the blood off. Okay. It's, maybe that joke is not in the best of taste. But I can't say something like that, but Rav Gold can. The Jewish consumer should be a conscientious consumer, and use his conscience or her conscience when determining what to rely on and whether you want to support our cousins in Gaza and buy their carrots. Well, a lot of it comes from overseas and other countries, but a lot of it comes from the Middle East. And it's not always clear, by the way, if you shop in Osher Ad or another Mahadran supermarket, it's not always so clear where the produce is coming from. It just says that it's Yibul Nochri. It's Gentile produce. Okay. I don't know. Right. Yep. So again, I urge the consumer to shop with his or her conscience. There's a big move in the religious Zionist world in recent years to rely on Otsar Beit Din, whereby the Beit Din comes in and pays the farmer for his time and his expenses, his resources, but not for the actual produce. You can't sell the produce, but they are able to compensate the farmer and distribute the produce. But that's only a solution for things like fruit and wine and things that don't require real planting and working of the land. Other solutions, planting in the Arava, which is within the borders of the modern state of Israel, but don't have Kiddushat Haaretz, parts of the land of Israel in the south and southwest that don't have the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, or Matzah Menutak, growing in a way that's detached from the ground, growing in greenhouses or using hydroponics, new advances in agricultural technologies. I think that is ultimately going to be the future of how we approach Shemitah Mahadrin, growing off the ground, growing hydroponically, growing in greenhouses, etc. Although there are those who even oppose that. Most farmers, supermarkets, grocery stores, shops, and restaurants around the country hold by the Heter Mechira. They rely on this Heter Mechira. It's interesting. You look in some of these Sfarim, some of these books written about the laws of Shemitah, and you see the way Heter Mechira is described there. Oh, you know, all the Gedolim were against it. All the Gedolim opposed it, as we saw together this morning and last week. Not true. You had many great Gedolei Hador, many great Gedolei Poskim who approved it. But I think that nowadays, maybe there's a different way of looking at it. You know, you could argue that, well, nowadays, thank God, we live in an affluent Western country, the modern state of Israel, with all of its problems and challenges, is the startup nation. Surely they can support Jewish farmers to observe the laws of Shemitah properly, kidatu kidin, without having to rely on the heter mechira. And you could say, well, you know, maybe the concerns that those poskim, like Rav Shmuel Mohalever and Rav Shua Trunk of Kutna and Rav Klapfish and Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, and even later Rav Kook, maybe they're not valid nowadays. But I think there are other concerns as well. While maybe sustaining a young yeshuv is not so much of a concern nowadays, maybe pikuach nefesh is not so much a concern nowadays, but certainly there are other concerns that we should be concerned for. Making kashrut as easy and as accessible as possible, not just for the religious community, but for the entire country. And isn't that something that we want, to make Torah observance as easy and accessible as possible for the broader public? I will end with that question. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you all in Mitzvah Shem next Wednesday.